I think we need a software update. Sorry about that. Thank you for being here, members and visitors alike. We've already called your attention to Exodus chapter 33. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time talking about this particular story exactly. But many of you are aware of the background, and we took time to read a good portion of the story this morning, so we don't have to go back and review a bunch of it. Moses is a remarkable character in many, many ways. He had a relationship with God that is unlike most others, including most others of the great ones of the Bible. And like all true servants of the Heavenly Father, he wanted a deeper and more meaningful relationship with the Heavenly Father, for which he is to be commended. We all should want the same thing. The closer the better is what Moses wanted from God. And for Moses, that meant seeing the glory of God in an even greater sense than he had already. Now remember, Moses has encountered God, pardon me, in a pretty remarkable way over a fairly long period of time, even at this point. For years now, he has been communicating with God for practical purposes directly. This began at the burning bush, remember, at Sinai, back in his wandering days. He had encountered this bush that was not being consumed yet. It was on fire, and God spoke to him through the bush. This was a representation of the presence of God, to the point where Moses was required to take his sandals off. He was in the presence of God, for all practical purposes at least. God was not the fire, nor was he physically located in the fire, but it was a representation of God. And in numerous ways after that, God would communicate his will to Moses. And by and large, Moses would listen and he would comply, and the relationship between Moses and the Father grew. And it culminates here at Sinai again, where the thundering and lightning that was given to everyone as part of his communication with his people, they begged that to cease. And no, we don't want that. And so Moses himself communed with God for an extended period of time on the mountain, for weeks at a time. He was in close proximity with some representation of God, at least. And powerful enough a representation, direct enough, where it had a physical transformative effect on Moses. We read about that later in the text. This was not enough for him. Show me your glory. And we assume, I assume, maybe you don't, I assume, that what Moses means by that is that he understands that the demonstrations of God and the presence of God that he has seen to this point are representational. He didn't actually look like a fire. He didn't actually sound like thunder. But he was real. And he wanted to see him in his actual presence. That's the way I've heard it usually described and usually explained, and I tend to think that's true. At least a better explanation for who God is. And God said, no, I can't do that for you. Not in the way that you mean, at least. Because you can't look on me and live. Not in my face, at least. But he provided a way in which Moses could be exposed to part of God's glory, a kind of a sideways view, if you will, or backward view might be a better way of phrasing it. He's placed in this cleft in the rock where a very narrow aperture, a very narrow opportunity of vision is going to be seen. For a very brief period of time, God is going to demonstrate himself, not in his full glory, not his face, but his back. This will flash before Moses very briefly. And he would be protected by God from the incredible glory and power that even this small manifestation was going to mean. Now, I am not in position to explain to you exactly what happened that day. I wasn't there. The words that are given to us describing this event or the event that would happen, the event itself isn't in the Bible, but we trust that God was true to his promise and that it did happen. Very limited information, though, on exactly what this meant and what how representational even this appearance of God would be. What we do know is this. It was not what Moses wanted. But we assume, at least, Moses being a person of faith, that seeing the back of God was enough. That this satisfied him. It may remind us of a couple of Bible stories from the New Testament. Remember, in John chapter 6, chapter 14 rather, Philip says a remarkable thing. After Jesus has said, I'm the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. While we're on the subject coming to the Father, how about you give us a view? How about you show us the Father? Show us the Father and suffices us. What a great statement there. You know, if we were to ask for one thing, one little thing, it might be that we'd be able to see God. That would be really great. If you could arrange that, we'd be okay with that. We wouldn't ask for anything else. That's kind of a ridiculous thing for Philip to say, isn't it? And Jesus reminds him what God told Moses on this particular day, that that's not the way that it works. You don't look on God in his actual form. It's a rather presumptuous thing to ask, in fact. Similar to what the apostles had asked on previous occasions. Remember, the mother of James and John had come to Jesus and said, why don't you let one of my boys sit on your right hand and one on your left in your kingdom? Wouldn't this be a terrific seating arrangement? After all, you care for my boys. We'll give them these prime spots here. We don't know what we ask sometimes. We're more presumptuous than we realize. And what we ought to do is have enough faith to accept what God shows of himself and suffice ourselves with that, rather than giving terms to God and saying, if you could just show us the meaning of this or the explanation of that, or if you could give us a real clear, concise explanation of what we need to do or what we need to not do, that would be great. If you could just reveal yourself to us in the way that we have chosen, we would be satisfied. Sometimes God does that. Sometimes God reveals himself in such a clear and demonstrable and undeniable way that we cannot help but understand his will, if we are of a mind to understand it. And sometimes he shows us his back. And we don't mean that in a disrespectful kind of way. I don't think God means it as a sign of disrespect to us. It's a gesture of faith, though, a test of faith. For us to see this demonstration of God as God has chosen to demonstrate. And then for us to say, thank you for that. And we'll find our contentment there. So what I want to do is take some practical lessons from this basic story here of seeing the back of God and explain a little bit how that might work in a practical kind of sense to us and kind of takeaways for us here. First of all, and most practically, I guess you might say, God is going to explain himself to us as best he can. And what I mean by that is that there are limitations on our ability as human beings to understand divine things. I've never been to Paris, France, and I can look at pictures, I can hear the testimony of people who have been there, I can watch movies set in France and set in Paris and such, and derive some concept of what it must be to be in Paris, France. But it will not be the same, could not possibly be the same, as if I had actually been there. You just can't duplicate that kind of information passage. Well, likewise, God demonstrates himself in the way that he does. But the bottom line is, God, as a multidimensional being, as one who is not imprisoned by space or time, simply does not fit within the scope of a human experience. We as human beings have limitations placed on us that make it impossible for us to fully comprehend who God is or what God is. Time maybe is the most obvious example here. God is timeless. We can understand that enough to accept it by faith, but as far as actually comprehending what it means to live outside of time, to not exist on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis, would be like explaining nuclear physics to a cockroach. You know, it's just not going to fit inside that little bitty brain. And God's not going to fit in our brain either. There are a variety of passages that we could turn to and that kind of touch on this theme. I like the text in Psalm 103, verse number 13 and following, trying to explain here that the difference between God and us. Just as the Father has compassion on His children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear Him. That's us, or should be us. For He Himself knows our frame. He is mindful that we are but dust. As for man, his days are like grass. As a flower of the field, so he flourishes. When the wind has passed over it, it is no more, and its place acknowledges it no longer. But the loving kindness of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting on those who fear him, and his righteousness to children's children, to those who keep his covenant and remember his precepts to do them. This takes us back all the way to the beginning, to Genesis chapter 2. Where God took dust from the ground and constructed from those physical elements a human being and breathed life into him. And he became a living soul, the text says. And that one gave rise to another, and they had children. And here we are, multiple generations later. But we're still the dust. In a physical sense, at least. We are physical matter. And I'm aware that God has given us a spirit that is not physical. But we haven't seen that. We don't have a very good concept of that. We accept that by faith. What we see is the flesh. And the flesh is what separates us from God, what distinguishes us from God. The dust can't relate to the one that breathed life into the dust. Our days are like grass, he says. When the wind's passed over, it is no more. We're here and we're gone. And he's not saying here that life is irrelevant or meaningless. That's not his point at all. His point is that we have life and then we don't have life. God's not like that. And simply because he exists separate from time and we are imprisoned by time, there is a degree of separation that we cannot get past, that we're incapable of getting past. And so therefore, we have a difficult time relating to God. And I would suggest to you that the best way to see God is to try to separate ourselves from time. To not see God in the moment, although we could see God in the moment, but to see a protracted exposure to God. It's not just that God made the sunrise. God makes every sunrise. It's not just that God gave me a child. God gave all of us life. God continues. And many, many times in the Bible, Old and New Testament alike, God is seen as this perpetuating, ongoing constant in the world that holds everything together. Jesus Christ, the Word, the Son of God, is said to be in Colossians the one through whom all things consist. And that's a great word. I love that concept there. He's the glue that holds us all together. The force that sustains the universe every single day. It's not just that God showed up today and gave us something that we liked and that we appreciated. God is always here. We have difficulty comprehending that. We are separated because of the sin that is on our record. Because we are sinful creatures. And I don't want to get all Calvinistic on you here. I'm not suggesting here that we couldn't help it, that we didn't have any choice in the matter. But there is a very real sense in which we have a nature about ourselves. A tendency that we, whether we can escape it or not, is not really the point. We don't escape it. And we find ourselves going back over and over again. And the idea of a holy God that does not have these kind of wrestlings, that does not have these kind of temptations, that is not dragged through the mud of sin like we are, it is extraordinarily difficult for us. The mere fact that we have sin on our record creates this gap that makes it difficult for us to appreciate God for who He is. Back up to verse number 6. Of Isaiah chapter 55. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return to the Lord. And he will have compassion on him and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts, the words of God here, are not your thoughts, nor are my way your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Now, that passage is taken out of its context a bit sometimes, and I've done it, to try to argue the point that God is more clever than we are, and that his plan may or may not make sense to you, but you need to just kind of accept that by faith and go along. And I think that's a legitimate point. That's certainly a Bible point. I'm not sure that's the main point that he's getting at here in Isaiah, though. Because in the context of Isaiah 55, we're talking about holiness. The reason that we seek Him, the reason that we are to draw ourselves closer to Him, is because we find in Him a holiness that we ourselves cannot achieve. His thoughts are higher than our thoughts. His are always noble. Ours, let's be charitable and just say less so. His ways are always right. Our ways far too often are not. How many times have we found our children, parents, engaging in some kind of mistake, some kind of bad behavior, maybe a protracted behavior, and we fuss at them and maybe we punish them in some fashion. And then after things have cooled down, we get back with the wife or the husband, we talk about this, and we find ourselves, you know, when I was their age, I did exactly the same thing. That was me. I did worse than that. I can relate. I can connect to that. Because they're just like me. And woe be unto them for being just like me. We get that. There's a similarity there. There's a commonality there. We do not share that with God. That causes problems. Sometimes it causes us to balk. Sometimes it causes us to rebel. I don't have anything in common with God. I'm going to reject God. But hopefully we have enough faith to overcome that and seek Him out specifically for the same reason that other people are rejecting Him. Because He is higher. Because He is holier. In the meantime, though, we have to acknowledge realities of the situation. That God is never going to completely and totally make sense to us. And I realize if you have a predisposition toward atheism, this is going to be a barrier that you're just not going to be inclined to try to get over. I get that. But if you're an honest seeker, if you genuinely want to know about higher things, whether there is in fact a God, hopefully you will be astute enough and diligent enough to acknowledge that seeking for this unattainable God is ultimately a far nobler quest than trying to dumb God down somehow, bring Him down to our level. And faith is an important part of the equation here. We need to come to God in faith and believe that when God explains himself to us, whether it's through a burning bush or through a voice through the mountain or whether it's in his holy word, that when God is revealing himself to us, he is going to do so in the way that is best for us. And when you think about that, I think you will agree that this is a reasonable conclusion to come to. Because after all, why would God create us and then hide from us? Why would he create us and then lie about himself to us? That wouldn't make any sense, would it? Seems more reasonable to my feeble human mind that when God communicates, it is in such a way as to be understood. That's the way I communicate with my children. And usually that's the way they communicate with me. Sometimes I'm not quite sure. That's the way human beings operate. And that's the way God operates with us. Now, again, this is all about faith. Do you believe that God has his hand on the switch? Do you believe that God is doing the right thing when it appears to our feeble human minds that he's doing the wrong thing? The book of Habakkuk is really all about this, and we don't have time to read the entire book of Habakkuk, but I'll bring a couple of things to your mind, and you can go back and study this a little bit later on your own. Habakkuk is a man of faith, someone who is genuinely horrified at the spiritual state of his country and cannot believe that God would allow this to go on. Surely a holy God would do something about this. And it's a challenge to Habakkuk's faith. Is God really the God that I thought he was? And God speaks to Habakkuk and says, yes, I'm the God that you thought I was. Yes, I see the affliction of the punishment that is due my people, and I'm going to punish them. I'm going to punish them through the coming of the Babylonians or the Chaldeans. They're going to come, and they're going to punish the nation. And Habakkuk says, hold on a second, that's not exactly what I had in mind. Right, verse number 5 and 6 there. Look among the nations, observe, be astonished, wonder, because I'm doing something in your days you would not believe it if it were told. For I believe, behold, I'm raising up the Chaldeans, that fierce and impetuous people who march throughout the earth to seize dwelling places which are not theirs. And he goes on to describe how they are. I love the way he phrases that. I do see, Habakkuk, and I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do about it, but I'll tell you beforehand, you're not going to believe what I tell you. And then he tells him, Habakkuk says, I don't believe it. Well, I told you we weren't going to believe it. Verse number 12. Habakkuk speaking there. Are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We will not die. You, O Lord, have appointed them to judge, and you, O Rock, have established them, the Chaldeans, he means, to correct. Your eyes are too pure to approve evil, and you cannot look down on wickedness with favor. It's appropriate that punishment come to wicked people. But, he says there in the tail end of verse 13, why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they? Granted, our people are wicked. Granted, our people need punishment. But exalting somebody who is far worse than we are doesn't make any sense. And he feels comfortable saying so. Many of the Psalms read the same kind of way. And he affirms his faith through all of this. Verse 12, are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? This is your plan, but I don't get it. And he's going to say his piece. And then in verse number 1 of chapter 2, he's done. He's said what he had to say. I will stand on my guard post and station myself on the rampart, and I will keep watch to see what he will speak to me and how I will reply when I am reproved. The assumption is I'm wrong on this. I have to be wrong. I couldn't possibly be right about this. Because I'm saying God doesn't know what he's doing. And God does know what he's doing. He's got to. Then the Lord answered me and said, record the vision and inscribe it on tablets that the one who reads it may run. For the vision is yet for the appointed time. It hastens toward the goal and it will not fail. Though it tarries, wait for it, For it will certainly come, it will not delay. Behold, as for the proud one, his soul is not right within him, but the righteous will live by his faith. What a great message for us there. You're talking about a message that you can't understand. And I'll grant you, this is tough, God's saying essentially in so many words. I'll give you another message. And this one you're going to get. This one you're going to understand completely. Now, the image of reading and running in our era of, well, back in the olden days, I guess, the fastest way to communicate with somebody would have been Federal Express, right? And we're past that now. Throw away all your Federal Express analogies. Now you got instant messaging and emails and all that kind of thing, right? Have you ever tried to text somebody when you're walking somewhere? You ever tried to read somebody else's text? It's kind of messed up, right? It doesn't work very well. Unless you got one of those tablets the size of a helipad. You know, maybe you can read it then. I don't know. Back then, if you had a message, you gave somebody a piece of stone. Or if you felt pity for them, you gave them a piece of wood. And you would cover that block of whatever with wax. And you would take a stylus and you would write in that wax. And then you'd carry that. The little kids would say, that can't possibly be true. How in the world could that work? This is what people did back then when they couldn't find any paper and ink. It was before they had paper and ink. And they would write it on this piece of wood or whatever. And then they'd give it to a runner. They'd give it to a messenger. And the messenger would carry that block of wood to some distant location, miles and miles away. And he would get to that location and he'd pass off the wood and the message would be received. Now, imagine what it would be like if that runner tried to read that block of wood. Assume you know the language in the first place. You know, he's writing here in Hebrew, you probably couldn't understand it anyway, but assume you could. Can you read while you're running? How clear must the text be if you're able to do that? That's how clear this message is going to be. I am sending my message to the people. And while you, Habakkuk, are carrying that message, you are going to understand it absolutely completely. The one who runs is able to read this message. And what is the message, this absolutely clear message? The righteous shall live by his faith. The inner workings of the mind of God may or may not be understood by you, by me, by our neighbors or whatever. But this much is sure. If you have faith, if you believe in God, if you believe in his power, if you believe that he is reaching out to you and trying to get you from here to there, that faith will see you through these difficult times. That faith will empower you to accept God as he reveals himself and not get all stressed out and doubtful because he doesn't understand himself, or that he doesn't express himself the way that you wish he would explain himself. If he chooses to show you his back, we can expect and believe that that is what is in our best interest. Kind of following up on that, point number two. God will sometimes protect us from ourselves. God tells Moses here on this occasion in Exodus 33 that no one can see my face. No one can look on my face and live. Now, if that were a regular emperor saying that, you remember the story of Esther. I think Brother Owens talked about Esther last Wednesday. And it was against the law, literally, to welcome yourself into the presence of the emperor. If you walked into the presence of the emperor, you were subject to the death penalty. You can't look on the emperor and live unless the emperor chooses to allow you to live. Essentially, is what he's saying here. That may be what God means here. It may mean that if I show you any more than I'm showing you now, I'm going to have to kill you. Maybe that's what he means. I don't think that's what he means. I think what he means is, you can't handle more than this. That simply because you're a human being, because you exist in three dimensions, a proper understanding of who I am, of what I look like, will make your mind explode, and I don't mean that figuratively. It will literally blow your mind. And so therefore God shields us from what we want for ourselves, but are in fact not in position to receive. We are not fit as human beings. As good as we may be, as noble as we may be, we are not fit for the burden of glory. We, as we labor here on earth, are not in position to welcome into ourselves, into our minds, into our hearts, God in His fullness. And I find it interesting that the people who live on the perimeter of this, the people who experience God in a greater, more direct, more spectacular sense than you and I do, typically regretted that. I find that interesting. Would you like to have been on Mount Sinai, or at Mount Sinai, maybe a better way of phrasing it? Wouldn't it be amazing to see the things God did, you know, the parting of the Red Sea, the 10 plagues, and all that kind of thing? And then for Him to actually reveal Himself, to hear the voice of God, or what poses as the voice of God anyway, with the thunder and the lightning and all this kind of, what a spectacular thing. I would give anything to be able to experience that. Well, thousands upon thousands of people did, in fact, experience that, and they thought they were going to die. They said, God, deliver us from this. Please do not make us go through this anymore. Speak to Moses. He can handle it. And then Moses can talk to us. But do not speak to us anymore, lest we die. And there are other examples, too, that are less spectacular than this. People who saw angels thought they were going to die. Not because the angel was particularly scary, but because he represented God. I've been welcomed into the presence of God. I'm not fit for this. And I think that shows a remarkable astuteness that a lot of people in the modern day lack. It is best for us to remain at a distance, to accept the glory that God has given us in the way that He has given it, rather than yearning for some kind of close encounter of the terriblest kind that might somehow or another explain God a little bit better. We do not want the burden of foreknowledge. How many of you would like to know the future? You'd make a killing on the stock market or in Vegas if you knew the future, right? What an amazing thing that would be. Show up at the racetrack and pick 20 winners in a row. Walk away with millions and millions of dollars. That would just be amazing. I'm not condoning gambling here or cheating at gambling. But the upside's obvious, right? But what about the downside? Can you imagine how horrible it would be to know everybody's future, to know your own future? Now, exactly at what level, to what degree God knows the future of mankind, I'm not in position to say. But I do know this, that God has a level of knowledge that is so far beyond us and above us as to be terrifying. And God delivers us from that. Time is a blessing to us. He allows us to live moment to moment. We're not able to handle anything else. I like the way that it's phrased in Isaiah 41, verse number 21. A little sarcasm in the mouth of God here. Present your case, the Lord says. Bring forward your strong arguments, King of Jacob says. Let them bring forth and declare to us what is going to take place. As for the former events, declare what they were, that we may consider them and know their outcome, or announce to us what is coming. Declare the things that are going to come afterward, that we may know that you are gods. Indeed, do good or evil, that we may anxiously look about us and fear together. Behold, you're of no account, and your work amounts to nothing. He who chooses you is an abomination. We had somebody just in the last couple of weeks, maybe you heard about this, somebody who said that the Lord was coming yesterday. Did y'all hear anything about this? That this was the big day. Yesterday was the day because of one interpretation of whatever. And I happen to notice, I don't spend a lot of social media time on game day. I find out I think poorly of my brethren when I look at social media too much on game day. But I happened to look and notice that he kind of retracted his statement late on Saturday. He said, you know what? I was mistaken on that. He's not going to come today. It's more of a kind of a general thing. He's coming around today. These are signs. It's not a particular day. It's just sometime around, you know, the kind of thing. You know how this goes. Well, I don't know exactly how many people set their calendar based on this fellow's say-so. How many people sold all their 401k stock and climbed up on the mountain and started waiting for the Lord. I don't know how many people did that. But I think it would be safe to say that if somebody based their entire life on someone who claimed to know the future like that, they made a mistake. And certainly events panned out that way. You are of no account, God says, to such ones. You people who claim to know the past and claim to know the future. That's not our place to know such things. God has that place. And therefore, we as people of faith are eager to allow him to do such things. For him to tell us what was in the past. For him to give some vague notion, at least, of what was going to happen in the future. And as he explains the future, we accept what he says, and we accept the limits to what he says, and we don't try to go beyond what he has said, including generalities and specifics about end time events. In Jeremiah chapter 29, he gives the people there some information about his future for them. And I realize that a lot of wall hangings and knickknacks around people's houses have taken this to mean something personal for you. And maybe you can take a personal message from this. But don't go too far with this. Because he says specifically what he's talking about. Verse number 10. For thus says the Lord, when 7 years have been completed for Babylon, I will visit you the Jews, and fulfill my good word to you, to bring you back to this place. For I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and hope. What he's saying there is that he has a plan for them. And he gives them a little bit of information about when it's going to come. But not how. Not details. But I have the plan. I know, he says. I know the plans that I have for you. You don't know the plans, but I know them. And that's good enough, or it should be good enough for you. You can have confidence in me that I can see the future. And the future that I have planned for you is a good future if you will trust in me and go in the way that I've told you to go. We're not worthy of the burden of judgment. There is a responsibility that is given to God, particularly regarding end time events, regarding heaven and hell, regarding eternal punishment, eternal damnation, eternal reward, that we oftentimes want to ascribe to. This person's good enough for heaven, this person less so, and so therefore they're in and they're not so much in. We like to do that sometimes, and we put ourselves in a very difficult position, because ultimately we are not equipped for this. And this is one of those places, and there's so many of them, where we need to be content with saying, thus says the Lord. It's not so much a matter of I say you're not pleasing to God. It's a matter of this is what God has said about himself. And this is what he said about us. And this is what he said about this particular behavior or this absence of behavior, as the case may be. It's not my condemnation, as though my condemnation meant anything or should mean anything. There's a story given to us in Jude of Michael the archangel opposing the devil in some spiritual fashion that we don't have a great deal of insight into. But we are given at least this, that Michael had enough regard for spiritual things, even evil spiritual things, to not pronounce a railing judgment against the devil, but to say, the Lord rebuke you. I find it interesting, in a scary sort of way, that an archangel does not see it appropriate to rail against the devil himself But we, as flawed, limited creatures of the Creator, oftentimes feel perfectly comfortable railing against people who do not meet up with our own personal standard. To say nothing of the dismissive things that we sometimes say about the devil himself. It is not our burden. And we should be thankful for this. We are not fit to see things as God sees them or to pronounce ourselves as somehow representatives of God other than he has in the way that he's empowered us to do so. And let me emphasize this also before we close up. Being witness to the back of God is still being witness to God. His back is still his presence. And knowing what we know and what I can infer about Moses from the text, I suspect that Moses was more than content with this. The meekest man on earth would have seen this demonstration of God and marveled and humbled himself and worshiped. Not in regret that he was kept from what he actually wanted, but that he was graced to the degree that he was able to receive what God had given him. This is still the presence of God. And I want to emphasize this point particularly. And I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this, but a few moments at least. Because we want to feel God in our lives. And we're surrounded by a religious culture that really, really emphasizes this, I think to a dangerous degree. The idea that if you can't feel God, if you can't watch God, if God is not close enough to you that you can sense him palpably, then somehow there's something wrong with you. That you're just not holy enough to experience God. Well, I'll grant you, you're not holy enough to experience God, at least in the fullest sense of the word. But God does not always demonstrate himself in the earthquake. He does not always demonstrate himself in the fire. Elijah had trouble seeing this. You remember the context in 1 Kings chapter 19. In chapter 18, the text that we read a little bit more often, at Mount Carmel, he had this grand showdown with the prophets of Baal and Ashtoreth and with King Ahab himself. And God demonstrated in the most spectacular way imaginable that he was, in fact, God. This tremendous victory. The greatest victory imaginable for Elijah. And really more to the point, for God. And I suspect, although the text doesn't say so in so many words, I suspect that Elijah saw this victory as a turning point. That things are going to be different from here on in. Ahab has seen this. Jezebel has seen this. The people certainly have seen this. And there's not going to be any more vacillating between the two. God has shown himself to be God. There's no way anybody possibly could have missed this. Because that's the way I read 1 Kings 18. And we turn the page, and absolutely nothing has changed, except maybe gotten a little worse. Jezebel wants to kill Elijah now, because he has opposed her, opposed her things, killed her prophets. Where is the earthquake? Where is the fire? Why hasn't God shown himself? After this tremendous display before, why this complete silence now? And Elijah is ushered into this cleft of the rock. Some have suggested the same cleft of the rock that Moses was in back in Exodus 33. I don't know how you could possibly prove that one way or the other, but it's an interesting story anyway. And he puts him in this little hidey hole. And he's going to see God. That's the implication, at least. And there's this earthquake, and there's this fire, these tremendous signs, but God was not in them. What does that mean? I don't know what that means. It means what it says. This was not a demonstration of the presence of God, essentially, I guess is what it's saying. And then there was this sound of a gentle blowing. And again, the implication is that's where the presence of God was. And the point that I've always taken from this, and that I'll share with you, is that God does not always show himself in the big things. Sometimes it's in the little things. But it's still God. If you were hoping for some kind of affirmation of the presence of God today, and you were thinking that you would see it when you opened up your morning paper and found out that the dictator of North Korea had been assassinated, or that some political movement had come to this huge and embarrassing and complete and total end, or whatever it happens to have been, and you did not see that, that was probably pretty disturbing for you. But if you woke up early enough to see the sunrise, or if you looked at a plant under a microscope, or if you examined your own circulatory and digestive system and all the things that make you a human being, these ordinary kind of things, everyday kind of things, and if you saw God there instead of in the earthquake and in the fire, isn't it still God? Isn't it still marvelous, in fact? You can hear the sound of the gentle blowing if you want to hear it. If you're of a mind to, it's still God. Now, Elijah is so deafened to such things with his own sense of self-pity here. And he's got some cause. Woe is me. You know, look at all the things I've done and all things have been done to me, and not one of them left. Now they're trying to kill me. By focusing so much on what's going on in his own life, he is deaf to the things God is trying to tell him. So God tries to open up his ears a little bit. By the way, you're not alone. You've got 7,000 haven't bowed the knee to Baal yet. So instead of feeling sorry for yourself, go back home and I'm going to give you some jobs to do. You're going to accomplish my will. Any demonstration of God surely is a blessing. It's really easy for us to pick and choose. Naaman wanted to pick and choose. Remember the story in the next book over? In 2 Kings chapter 5. I thought the prophet was going to do this and this and this. I've got this leprosy, and I've seen people, you know, with the healing powers and such, and they were all fakes, or they would have worked on me. But yeah, they did all this waving and dancing and shouting and such, and came out and struck me, and that's what I thought was going to happen, except it was actually going to work. And he wouldn't even come out of his house. Go wash in that dirty Jordan River 7 times. That'll be good enough. That's not what I expected. But it's still God, isn't it? It's still the power of God. And if God chooses to involve himself in your life and cleanse you and bless you, surely that's good enough, isn't it? Simply dwelling in his house, being privileged to be a partaker of his things in this glorious place, isn't that blessing enough for us? I like the language in Psalm 27. In a verse number 4. One thing I have asked from the Lord that I shall seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord, to meditate in his temple. For in the day of trouble he will conceal me in his tabernacle. In the secret place of his tent he will hide me. He will lift me up on a rock. And now my head will be lifted up above my enemies around me. I will offer in his tent sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing, yes, I will sing praises to the Lord. That's all I want, David says, to be in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. And part of that is a practical thing, because this is where worship goes up. This is where I feel the presence of the Lord. And what a marvelous thing it is to be in the literal place where these things happen. But I think the figurative lesson is much more important. To be in the spiritual presence of God, to be a part of his family, to be a part of his house, to be acknowledged as I belong with God. And I know that, and the people who know me know that. And for that to be the case all the days of my life, what more could I possibly want out of that? Do you count your blessings every day? Do you acknowledge your spiritual blessings, I mean? Do you realize how blessed you are to be a child of God? And that's apart from the current circumstances and air conditioning and all that kind of thing. The spiritual blessings, every single spiritual blessing in the heavenly places are yours in Christ Jesus. Ephesians 1 verse 3 tells us that. How much more do you want beyond that? Isn't that enough? Because what you have is something that no one else has ever had. You're a Christian. If you've been bought by the blood of Christ, you are an adherent to the gospel of Jesus Christ. You are in a position that not only people of old, Abraham, Moses, David, all the rest of them, never could have had, never were going to have, but in a position that was, in fact, the envy of the angels themselves. Your participation in the gospel is something that angels, in fact, long to look into. They didn't understand it. They wanted to understand it. And you understand it. You have it revealed to you. Paul writes about it in Ephesians chapter 3. He talks about it being a mystery. But it's not a mystery in the sense that you don't understand it. It's a mystery that has been revealed to you. It's yours now. Paul ministered to us through the gospel. We turn around and minister to others as we carry that gospel to other people. We are participants in the eternal plan of God for the salvation of all of mankind. You're part of that. You are in the presence of God. And I realize it doesn't always feel that way. And maybe having a big picture of God up here or something would help. I don't know. I didn't have a picture of God to show you on the slides. Maybe there are ways that we could kind of gin up some artificial enthusiasm. But isn't it better to simply accept the wonder that is ours as the children of God in the presence of God, even if it's just His back, even if it's not everything that you would ask for? Isn't it enough for us to accept by faith that this is all we need and this is all we should want? And in fact, being blessed in this way is the best thing we possibly could have from the hand of God. Blessing is going to sustain us in this life and carry us over into the life that is to come. What a marvelous thing it is to see the back of God. Doesn't do any good, of course, if you are not welcomed into His presence. The back of God, as we've described it today, is very different than the back of God that you would see as He walks away from you. Now, I'm not sure exactly how the logistics are going to work on the Day of Judgment, but if what happens to us can be accurately described in modern terminology as God showing us His back, that's not a good thing. That's not what we want. Because we're looking forward to being in the full presence of God after this life is over. We don't want Him to turn His back on us. So don't turn your back on Him today. Embrace your opportunity and come to God. Accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. Put Him on in baptism. Be raised up to walk in newness of life. There's some who need to do that today. You haven't done it yet. So do it. Walk with Christ all the rest of your days and go to heaven when you die. If there's anything we do to help you walk in the presence of God or walk more accurately, more perfectly in the future, please respond to the invitation while we stand and sing at this time.